2596, Hyatt v. Lee. Please proceed, Mr. Panner.
Judge Moore, and may it please the Court, the relief that we seek in this case is quite narrow, actually. We seek to prevent the immediate publication of confidential information that the PTO intends to place in the files of five patent applications that are currently available to the public. But the principle that's at issue here is of much broader
And I just want to be clear about something regarding the confidentiality. Arguably, even the existence of filed pending applications is subject to 122. But if I understand it, because I had my clerk go back and look, the only thing that you've deemed confidential is the requirements. And it seems to be just the claim language, because the district court opinion, the briefs, lots of non-confidential parts, for example, talk about the number of pending applications, a little bit about priority chains, number of claims. Am I correct? I don't want to reveal something that is otherwise confidential, but it's my understanding that that's all fair game.
Oh, I appreciate that, Your Honor. The answer to that is that many of the things to which you refer have been treated as confidential. However, they have been published, a committee of Congress actually published some information concerning these applications. I think it's discussed in passing.
Well, your brief doesn't have that stuff designated confidential.
And so, because it is in fact public.
Okay. I just want to make sure that I don't tread on anything improper. So I'll steer clear of discussing particular amendments that may have occurred and or claim language. And is that about what I need to steer clear of?
I think that will be fine, Your Honor. And as you say, that our briefs, I think, do hew to a line along, you know, that hew to that line, and treat. We have tried to avoid having the briefs be confidential because it's inconvenient.
Restart his time at 15 minutes, just because I wanted to clarify the confidentiality. It shouldn't cut off against his time. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. So, as I say, the principle that is at issue in this case is of much broader importance. And Section 122 grants patent applicants an affirmative right to maintain their applications in confidence unless one of two statutory exceptions applies. And consistent with principles of statutory construction that the government has really not disputed, those exceptions must be construed narrowly, consistent with the core statutory purpose of protecting confidential information. Under the district court's ruling, however, the PTO has unreviewable discretion to publish patent applications whenever it considers a circumstance to be special, no matter how disconnected that special circumstance is.
I was surprised I didn't get a 28J letter from you on Judge Kagan's opinion last week, the EEOC opinion. Are you familiar with it?
I know the holding of that case, Your Honor, and obviously it does reinforce the notion that in a case like this one, the presumption of judicial review certainly favors a reading of the statute that would not confer unreviewable discretion.
There is a, quote, strong presumption favoring judicial review, and it fails when a statute's language or structure demonstrates Congress wanted an agency to police its own conduct, but the agency bears a, quote, heavy burden in attempting to establish that. I thought maybe you would find that language helpful.
It's extremely helpful, Your Honor, and I appreciate your Honor's pointing it out, because I do think that it reinforces the point that existed in the prior law, including cases like Bowen that we cited. I do think that the reviewability issue actually is quite plain that this is not a matter that was conferred to the agency's discretion by law, and unless the court has questions about that reviewability issue, I'd be happy to go to the merits.
Well, no, I'd like you to stick with that for a second. What are the criteria I ought to use to assess whether they properly determine that special circumstances exist? Divorce that in your mind, because I feel like there's some morphing of what I consider to be two discrete exceptions to confidentiality. Number one being necessary to carry out an act of Congress, or totally separate from that, such special circumstances as may be determined by the commissioner. So as you know, what the law on reviewability suggests is there has to be some delineatable set of standards that I can use to judge whether or not they've complied with what Congress intended.
Absolutely. And let me first try to articulate a general standard and then provide a couple of illustrations that are based on in the office's historical practice with regard to disclosure of otherwise confidential information. And the general standard is that a special circumstance must be one where disclosure of the information serves a significant statutory purpose under the Patent Act. So in other words, why is that the appropriate standard?
I think it just says special circumstances as may be determined by the commissioner. Why does it have to serve an important purpose under the statute?
I think that the statutory analysis that the Seventh Circuit has in the village of Palatine case helps to illustrate why that is so. Because the basic purpose of Section 122 is to establish the right of the patent applicant to maintain an application in confidence. And so then the question is, when would the Patent Office appropriately create an exception to that? It is when the disclosure itself is required to serve some significant statutory purpose. And so, for example...
But Congress said that in the very preceding example, and they set this one out as a different example. They say, unless necessary to carry out an act of Congress, or in such special circumstances the commissioner might determine.
Right,
so I feel like that's what I'm complaining about, your morphing in the brief of what feels to me like you're morphing two completely discrete and separate exceptions into a single one.
I don't think so, Your Honor. First of all, I don't think it's necessary that they be completely discrete. I think that certainly the special circumstances exception is intended to be something of a safety valve to ensure that if circumstances arise that have not been don't fall within the first one, that they will be covered. But let me try to explain the difference. The first exception is talking about a circumstance where for the director to carry out an act of Congress, it's necessary to disclose. That's the language of Section 122. The second exception talks about a circumstance where it may have nothing to do with what the director is doing. The director is not carrying out an act of Congress, but there's a statutory interest. So that's where I think the examples are so helpful, and they're the very examples that the PTO has cited in its brief as being historical examples of appropriate disclosure. And those were situations where there was a defendant in a patent infringement case, and they came to the office and said, I really need to see what's in that application, because I think it's going to show that this, you know, the scope of the patent is different from what's being claimed over in the infringement suit. Now, it's not necessary to carry out an act of Congress for the PTO to disclose in that circumstance, but it is a special circumstance in which that otherwise confidential information ought to be disclosed to ensure that the patentee doesn't have a right to exclude that's broader than what the office grants.
You, of course, are going to agree that the statute puts the PTO in charge of setting out procedures for processing and examining applications, right?
It does.
At a minimum, procedures.
Mm-hmm.
We won't touch substantive rulemaking. But procedures. Well, one such procedure that has existed since the 1960s is articulated in 37 CFR 1.75, and it was cited at least by the office, I believe maybe in your reply brief, but I don't remember for sure. And what it expressly says is more than one claim may be presented. This isn't an application. I was shocked to see this, quite frankly. It kind of blew me away because it's not the way I think of patent practice normally. But this has been consistently, without a single amendment, the rule since 1960 regulation. More than one claim may be presented, provided they differ substantially from each other and are not unduly multiplied.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. Why wouldn't the PTOs need to continue to comply with this regulation be a special circumstance that could warrant breaching confidentiality?
Well, Your Honor, and I think that this goes really to the core of the merits of the case. And I think that, in fairness, the most powerful argument that the government has been able to articulate, and it's one that has, I think, I would concede it has a certain surface appeal, is that they say, well, look, we're just doing our job trying to examine these applications, which present challenges for us. We're trying to do some. We're trying to do an examination here, and it just so happens that as a result of going through this process and the operation of our regulations as they exist, some information about confidential applications is going to get out there. And so, why is that ought to justify it? I think the answer to that is that Section 122. And this is where I think the standard that we're talking about has bite and ought to be applied by this court. Section 122 says you don't disclose it, you don't give it out unless there are special circumstances that by implication justify that disclosure. So nobody's saying...
But why wouldn't the special circumstances in this case be precisely what the PTO has articulated in the requirements? Because one of the things I looked closely at, Mr. Panner, was, is it possible that the PTO went too far in the requirements? Is it possible that some of the information they disclosed might be justifiable, and yet they went too far and other bits of it is not? But, I went through every single piece of the one requirement we have in front of us.
Yes, sir.
And why isn't the disclosure of each piece of that information justified by special circumstances? Mr. Hyatt has... and this is all stuff you say I can say, 115,000 pending claims all filed before 95. Don't even get me started on how that could possibly be. But he does. And so given the volume of the claims and the fact that the PTO has a reg, by the way, and that 115,000 claims in only 399 applications, and wait, the PTO has a reg that says more than one claim can be provided in an application, more than one. Well, I think that means he's got, more than 114,700 more than what this regulation starts at the premise with. More than one can be provided, provided they substantially differ from each other and are not unduly multiplied.
Your Honor, I guess, I really do want to try to go right to the heart of Your Honor's question, and let me do that by saying, let's assume, for present purposes, that for all of the reasons that the PTO says, we don't obviously agree with that, and there are reasons why the claims are so numerous. But leaving that, and there's a reason.
Some of them are identical.
And there's a reason why.
That's the whole thing about the requirements, and that's why I thought, at first I thought, well, maybe they don't need to disclose the claim language. Maybe they can disclose sort of the volume, and they can turn some of the burden on him to prove stuff, but maybe they don't need all the specific information. But what they showed us in this one requirement, I assume the others parallel this, is that lots of different claims in different applications are actually verbatim.
There are a couple examples like that, Your Honor, but the point that I'm trying not very effectively to get to is that whether those requirements had to be exactly as they were and whether that was 100% legitimate, which is not at issue in this case, the question is whether they need to be disclosed. What Mr. Hyatt is asking for in terms of relief is not that the requirements be withdrawn, not that they be edited, not that they be put in a different, that they say anything different from what they say, but that they not be published. And it is absolutely the very normal course of examination. Of course, every office action is loaded with confidential information. But the basic rule of Section 122 is you don't publish anything in a non-public application. What happened in this case, and the reason why we are here now, is that there were five applications that were already on public PAIR as a result of their relationship to issued patents. But
here's the problem. If I have to put the requirement into this particular case, one patent that I'm examining, I have to turn the burden on Mr. Hyatt to come forward with information and all of that. Mm-hmm. And then that patent issues. And then Mr. Hyatt sues a third party, maybe me, for infringement. holy cow, don't you think that third party needs to know what the PTO said in that requirement to properly understand the scope of his claims? Because maybe the examiner made statements about claim scope. We all know that would absolutely affect the claim scope that Mr. Hyatt ought to be able to enforce. And so doesn't the public have an absolute right, once that patent issues, to have everything that formed its part of its allowance?
And Judge Moore, the answer to that case is not yet before you.
That's exactly the case before.
It isn't, and we tried to explain this because the PTO obviously relies heavily and on the language of disclosure and the importance for potential infringers to know the scope of patents. There's no issued extant patent to which this relates. There are five applications that are public, not because those patents have been issued, but because they were parent applications of issued patents. That's the only reason that they were made public, pursuant to a rather recent PTO regulation.
That's a normal process, and those applications and everything contained within them become public. Why? So that the public will understand the full scope of the record and will understand why the Patent Office did whatever the Patent Office did, right?
Well, Your Honor, I think this does go right to the heart of the merits of this case and why the court ought to, in recognition of the significance of the statutory right and the breadth of the statutory right granted in Section 122, reverse what happened below and order relief granted, because there is no such interest in this case. There is no extant patent to which this information relates. If later a patent issues and this information is in that file history, that presents a different case. But what's going on here
is... Let me
just
be clear so I understand, because I don't know that I fully appreciated the facts the way that you're explaining them. Are you saying that this requirement was not only put into the file of the pending applications that were subject to examination, but it was somehow put into the file of applications that have already resulted in patents and has somehow become public? Stop shaking your head. You're driving me crazy.
No, Your Honor. Let me try again, because it's complicated, and obviously part of that is due to the number of different applications and the relationships, and I appreciate that. So let me, and we didn't do a good job of clarifying this in our reply brief, so let me try to back up. Mr. Hyatt has applications that are pending that are parent applications to issued patents. Okay, all of those issued patents are expired. So there is an application that is pursuant to a PTO regulation that we haven't directly challenged in this case, but that is actually of rather recent vintage, or at least vintage post his filing of these applications, that says if you are a parent application, this isn't the way it used to work, but if you are a parent application to an issued patent, we're going to make you available if somebody asks for it and pays a fee. Okay, it's a little bit different from we're going to just make it public, but that says if you want to get a parent application.
Okay, but if somebody asks for it and pays a fee, they can pop it up on the internet themselves at that point. There is no rule anywhere that says you don't have a harm argument.
No, we do, because the issue here is, was the PTO was it okay for the PTO to take this information from other applications, put it into the requirement document, publish it in that file, when we said to the PTO, look, we're not directly challenging your authority to make us provide you this information there may be other challenges to that. But for present purposes, the issue is we are asking you not to publish information about other applications in this application file. And there's no reason for you to do that. No circumstance justifies that disclosure. In other words, Section 122 What we are trying to do is enforce the right that is granted under Section 122 to say, let's take this seriously. It says that information, and it's always been taken seriously, and there's never been a case like this one that I'm aware of or that the PTO cites, where the PTO takes application information about a large number of applications and threatens to publish it on the internet.
There's probably never been another inventor like Mr. Hyatt either,
okay,
or at least an applicant.
No, I understand Your Honor's point, but to that, but it's a question of degree, and the point is there certainly have been many other circumstances where there have been related applications. Continuation practice is a common thing, and
you're way into your rebuttal time.
Yeah, but just one question.
Yes, sure.
But the information we're talking about here is publicly available.
No, it's not, Your Honor.
I thought you said it's in an application that is the parent of an issued patent. The patent may now be expired. That's fine. But and therefore is available if somebody asks for it.
The agreement that we had reached in order to avoid the need to seek any sort of preliminary relief, and frankly it was a courtesy that the PTO granted to ensure that this court and the lower court would have an opportunity.
I know where you're going.
Yes.
It's not there. I may have misspoke. It's not publicly available, but it would be but for this arrangement.
It would be
because
but for
the
this
rules
arrangement.
Would no- normally make that available.
Right. What this case is about is to say this cannot go... This in this form cannot go into this file because that would be a disclosure that would violate 122.
Yeah. All right.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Panner.
Thank you.
Mr. Freeman, if you need extra time, we certainly let Mr. Panner have a little extra time.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, Mark Freeman for the government. Let me just begin with the factual point on which we ended with Mr. Panner. Mr. Hyatt has at least 9 issued United States patents that, although expired within the last 6 years. Indeed, one of them was still alive and kicking when the complaint in this case was filed. It expired in August last year. That means that, as the Court is well aware, Mr. Hyatt could bring suit under those patents for retrospective damages against persons in the United States. That is the reason why we have a rule that if you have said things in the prosecution history of a parent application, that the people get to know that information so that they can understand the scope of the claims and correctly construe the scope of the patentee's exclusive rights. The requirements here, among other things, discuss why these claims violate the regulation that Judge Moore cited, which incidentally was tracks the reasoning of the CCPA in the In re Chandler case and in other cases. And indeed, as this Court knows...
That regulation shocked me.
I
don't know how much you are involved in actual patent prosecution, but I've never seen a one-claim patent, and the regulation almost makes it seem like each patent gets a claim, and if you want more than that, you got to justify it.
Right.
I don't see the PTO generally asking people to justify it either if you file.
I think most patent prosecutors, most patent attorneys submit claims. You know, you got a means plus function claim, you got a process claim, you got an apparatus claim, you vary the claims. What you don't do is submit, 9,500 claims for a given specification that are virtually identical. And this Court, the requirements themselves point this out. This is at page 212 of the joint appendix in the discussion in the requirements of the legal justification for the rule. But the requirements point out, look, this Court and its predecessor to the CCPA...
So here's one question I have from you about logistics. It doesn't go to the merits of this case. So the PTO charges by claim, correct?
Yes.
So Mr. Hyatt has paid big fat application fees when he submitted 9,500 claims in a particular spec.
That's
if
correct.
If you're now going to limit him to 600, are you going to refund that money since you are now not going to be prosecuting the other 8,000, whatever, 100?
Your Honor, I don't know the answer to the refund question directly. I'd be surprised, though, if we did, and I'll tell you why.
Yeah, me too.
But I'll tell you why. I mean, look, that regulation, as Your Honor pointed out, has been on the books since long before even the earliest possible application priority date.
The whole reason for making people pay for extra claims is the time that it'll take the office to prosecute them. And if you're going to, I'm not saying you haven't spent lots of time on Mr. Hyatt, but if you're going to refuse to prosecute his claims, shouldn't the man get his money back?
I don't think so. And let me tell you why. I mean, if you just take a typical double patenting rejection.
If I walk into McDonald's and order two burgers, and I hand them the money for two burgers and they hand me one, do you think I'm going to walk out without the other half of the money that I gave them?
I don't think so, Your Honor.
No. So why should Mr. Hyatt?
Because when you have a rule that says you may not present unduly multiplicitous claims, okay, and you come in and submit this many claims, you have broken the rule, and we may enforce that rule. No one here, including Mr. Hyatt, is challenging the validity of that principle. And the issue in front of us is whether the government, whether the PTO...
So your argument to me is we did prosecute these. We decided they were unduly multiplicitous.
Well, we haven't even decided that, to be fair, Your Honor. What the requirements say is, these sure appear to us to be identical or nearly so. Tell us why we're wrong. And incidentally, that underscores our point that if he comes back, imagine how he responds to this. In his petition to the agency, he said Section 122 encompasses his response to the requirement as well. If he comes back and says, no, you're wrong. You say claim 300 here is identical or similar to claim 287 over here, but actually you misunderstand. When I use this word, I meant a different thing, and that's patentably distinct. Of course, the public is entitled to that information. And all that we're saying in this case is that PTO gets to treat these office actions like any other office action. And Mr. Panner just stood
here.
But
these aren't called an office action.
Well, requirements. And requirements, as this court held in a case not coincidentally called Hyatt versus Dudas, is the sort of thing that an examiner can issue and that a patent applicant is required to respond to. Now, there's no doubt, we think, that the agency is entitled to do this, but that's not this case. What this case is, as Mr. Panner said, is about whether the agency can treat what is, for purposes of this appeal, a concededly valid agency action, like every other requirement or office action, and put it in the file of patent applications, and under long-standing, unchallenged PTO rules, make them available to the public in the ordinary course. If Mr. Hyatt wants to challenge the validity of those requirements, which he has done incidentally in petitions...
Well, but this isn't about ordinary course, because your entire right to do this is under your special circumstances exception. And so this is an ordinary course. And so wouldn't one of the special circumstances, for example, be what is the relevant harm? Now, Mr. Hyatt might not be harmed because, quite frankly, at least one spec in all of these chains has already been disclosed and he can't claim broader than the spec. And you might have just all the harm on your favor in this case.
Right.
But wouldn't one of the relevant factors be the extent of what you're seeking to disclose and whether that information is or is not sort of already publicly available in some other way?
Those are the things that the director took into account, Your Honor, but we don't think they're judicially reviewable.
Well, yeah, but okay, but suppose I think special circumstances is judicially reviewable. Wouldn't that be the sort of thing that would be part of the relevant inquiry? Since there is a general rule, you can't disclose it. You can in special circumstances. Wouldn't, if you're able to show that there really isn't any sort of generalized harm here because everything is already disclosed or otherwise available,
right,
that would be the kind of thing
certainly
that
in this case
support
the
your decision.
Yeah, certainly in this case, the director thought those things were relevant and made exactly that point in her decision, which appears at page 233 of the Joint Appendix. But I want to go back just to the statutory point. I'm sensing the skepticism, but give me a chance here. One thing, Mr. Hyatt treats this statute, on the special circumstances point, as though it says information in patent applications may be disclosed if it's necessary to carry out the provisions of an act of Congress or in special circumstances. But that's not what it says. It says, or in such special circumstances as may be determined by the director. And there is a long historical...
Isn't that possibly just an articulation of who ought to be the one to figure out the special circumstances?
Your Honor, I think...
Because there's lots of things in the PTO statute. Like, for example, if you want an exception to some sort of rule, who do you petition? The statute says, petition the director for a special exception.
That's true. And
stuff like that.
Right. And there are many places in the statute where Congress has given the director discretionary authority. You know, among other things, how to treat a patent application.
And do you think all of those
no.
are unreviewable?
No.
Just because it was specified who this had the authority to think them up?
Your Honor, this particular locution has a long historical pedigree. I mean, we cite in our brief the George S. Bush case from 1940. That's the case cited in the Attorney General's manual that's been understood to be informative in construing the APA. What the paragraph in that case, that critical Supreme Court case, explains is that there is a difference. The Supreme Court recognized it in Webster versus Doe as well. between saying a circumstance is objectively present or Congress saying when a particular officer believes in that officer's discretion that that particular circumstance is present. That is a long, I think the D.C. Circuit has called that distinction one of ancient and historical lineage.
And in neither of those cases was there a general rule and then an exception. That really changes the dynamic of this case as compared to these. Congress expressed a very clear intent in the form of 122 that applications be maintained in confidence and then carved out exceptions, which feel to me like they're meant to be quite narrow, necessary for an act of Congress.
Right, and I think that...
And then in special circumstances, it seems to me, ought not to be like this unwieldy, really broad thing.
And,
right?
And it has not been construed or applied that way, Your Honor, but...
But if it were, you're suggesting nobody could stop her. She's got free reign.
At least not on a non-constitutional basis. And let me just point to this court's precedent, for example, in the...
But do you recognize the distinction that I'm drawing, which I think is significant, between the two cases you cited, which I grant you conveyed authority to a particular person to set out circumstances,
right,
and this case where Congress expressed a general rule and then set out two narrow exceptions, one of which it gave authority to somebody to articulate?
I don't agree, and let me explain why. First, let me point to this court's decision, the only one I could find recently applying 701A2. That's the Allman Brothers case concerning a statute that allowed the U.S. Trade Representative to enter into certain agreements concerning softwood lumber with Canada. And in that statute, if you just look at the case, the statute laid out a number of requirements that any such agreement had to comply with. Some of them were justiciable. In fact, the court in the Allman Brothers case went ahead and addressed the challenger's arguments to some of them. But one of them was that the agreement be satisfactory to the U.S. Trade Representative. And the argument in the case was very much like the argument Mr. Panner made this morning. He goes, the applicant said, look, what is the purpose of this? It is to provide remedies to injured U.S. industry. I know that it says satisfactory, but it must mean satisfactory in a way that accomplishes the purposes of the statute. And this court said, we're happy to talk about your arguments on the other score, because we agree with you that that was meant to be reviewable. But that part is committed to agency discretion by law. And that follows from the text of Section 701 of the APA. Section 701 of the APA says, this chapter in the APA applies, except to the extent that agency action is committed to agency discretion by law. So this Congress contemplated in the APA...
Doesn't the AVA also afford a strong presumption of reviewability, and didn't Justice Kagan really reinforce this last week?
Yeah, I saw the mock mining case, Your Honor, and I'm happy to address it. I actually also expected a 28-J letter. That case, I think, reinforces the reasons why we're correct here. That involved, as you know, the power of their obligation on the EEOC to conduct conciliation before suing an employer on behalf of an employee. It didn't say conduct such conciliation as the administrator of the EEOC deems appropriate. What it said was you must conciliate. And the Supreme Court said that is justiciable. Justice Kagan also went on to say, though, that even that, because it is there is no standard in the statute for understanding what conciliation means, just like there's nothing here about what is special, all the court was willing to do was to say, did the fact of conciliation occur? And the court stresses, as Your Honor is aware, that it would not look at the underlying substance. It was just going to check the box to make sure it happened. So even there, where the court said, we agree it's justiciable, the statutory language was different, and the court emphasized even there how deferential the review was going to be, and they were not going to look at the content. So I think the most that Mr. Hyatt gets out of that decision, even if the court were to read it all for all that it is worth, is that if the special circumstances determination is subject to review in an APA action, it is only to make sure that the director has, for example, not decreed that all patents are special circumstances, but has identified a discrete subset and will not look at the underlying contents of that determination.
And you're saying that the director can select any set of circumstances whatsoever?
Well, I think that follows from the committed agency discretion by law, Your Honor. That is our principal submission.
Doesn't that, in effect, totally negate the first part of the statute, which says that the Patent Office shall maintain these things in confidence?
No, I don't think it would, Your Honor, in the same way that the statute in...
It opens up every applicant to what that applicant would certainly argue is arbitrary action by simply by virtue of the fact that the director just selects on a whim some class of cases that will be published or some such thing.
Your Honor, on a whim might raise a constitutional question, and the Webster versus Doe made clear that constitutional claims are not foreclosed, but let me answer your question. That sort of hypothetical, of course, comes up in every committed agency discretion by law case. I mean, there were arguments in Webster versus Doe that this would mean that the director of the CIA could fire any person for any reason with unreviewable discretion.
And you know what? I'd be okay with that, right? It's the CIA. It's like you just cannot analogize that Congress intended the PTO to have unfettered discretion when it comes to rejecting patents.
Right.
And analogize that to the CIA and Homeland Security's decision about what is in the interest of national security. You can't make that analogy.
I appreciate that argument.
Please withdraw the analogy.
Well, I appreciate the point, but if I may, make what I think is the subsidiary point, which is valid. The court in that case said there is a difference between saying that firing a person may be fired when it is necessary and advisable in the interest of the United States, or what the statute actually said, which is when the director deemed it necessary and advisable in the interest of the United States. And in so holding, the court invoked the longstanding tradition that we have cited here that is not limited to national security cases. And furthermore, we don't need to equate the PTO with a national security agency, which, let me be clear, I am not equating the PTO with a national security agency. We don't need to equate the PTO with a national security agency to recognize that Congress used in Section 122 a particular locution that it does not use, to my knowledge, anywhere else in the Patent Act, and which has a historical tradition attached to it.
Just to be clear, is there any case that you have cited or can point me to which didn't just have a to-the-director kind of discretionary allocation, but which had as a predicate a general rule against that? Because you see, for me, it's about the structure of the statute and how the structure of this statute does differ quite substantially from every single case I could find where anyone analyzed it and decided it was unreviewable. In none of those cases could I find an example where the exception was part of a general rule.
Let me say two quick things on that, and then I'll just move off that point. The first is, I think the Allman Brothers case from this court does do that, because it provided that the agreements entered by the U.S. Trade Representative were reviewable, anticipated that they would be reviewed, but provided that a particular determination under that statute was not reviewable. Secondly, I just think
That's not the same. That's not an exception to the general rule.
Right.
That is an exception to reviewability, but that has nothing to do with the merits here. You see the difference.
Well, I do see the difference, but again, I mean, maybe perhaps we just are not going to see eye to eye on this, but I think the contemplation of Congress in Section 701 of the APA is that the APA applies, except to the extent that particular questions have been withdrawn from judicial cognizance. So here, we're not arguing that although the district court, and we've withdrawn this, the district court gave us more than we asked for and said the necessary to effectuate an act of Congress provision was not subject to review either. We didn't make that argument below, and we're not making it here. The special circumstances provision, though, is one that is withdrawn from judicial cognizance in our view. But let me leave that and say, if you think it is subject to review, then I think you ought to apply a filter much like Justice Kagan just did last week and say, look, if it is subject to review, it is subject to very deferential review to make sure that the basic...
Well, if it is subject to review, wouldn't the APA counsel that the appropriate standard is arbitrary and capricious? If you want me to follow the APA, shouldn't I go all in on it?
Well, I think that when we ask what is arbitrary or capricious, we still have to apply a substantive filter to decide what makes something arbitrary and what makes it capricious. The State Farm case, which sets out the basic meaning of arbitrary and capricious review in the Supreme Court, says that the question is whether you've considered the relevant statutory factors and considered the relevant facts. Well, we don't have any relevant statutory factors. That's part of our point. What is special is not, it's not a term of art in the Patent Act. It's nowhere defined by Congress. And one thing it doesn't say is the standard that Mr. Panner wants us to discuss this morning. It doesn't say balance the needs for disclosure against the needs for confidentiality. It doesn't say it has to fulfill some particular statutory requirement. It just says special. And if we're going to review, I mean, of course, our principal submission is that partly for that reason it's not subject to review, but if we're going to review special circumstances, we should be doing it like Justice Kagan just explained in the mock mining case, applying the question, did the director identify something called special circumstances that is perhaps smaller than the whole. And beyond that, there isn't really a basis in the Act for asking anything more. On the merits, just as I may, I don't think Mr. Hyatt has explained that his prosecution history practices, his prosecution practices are, I think the phrase he uses in his brief is unusual. We can debate whether that's an understatement. It certainly is within the discretion of the director to deem them special and make sure that the public has access to the basis on which the agency examines his applications and his responses thereto.
Can I ask you another? I know you want to sit down, but let me ask you
another
question.
I'm happy to stay as long as you need.
How could there be 115,000 claims that were filed prior to June 8th of 95? They're still kicking around.
Your Honor, I
don't understand.
Your Honor, I would welcome the chance to litigate that question in open court. I'm constrained in what I can say on that score. I can tell
the record suggests that some of the applications may have been stayed while others went through board or federal circuit review. As far as I know, we're not that slow.
No.
Right? 20 years, it's not my fault, right?
Your Honor, there is... No. We don't suggest that it's the court's fault. And I don't suggest that PTO is entirely blameless on this, but I think that if you look at the requirements, one of which, as Your Honor noted, appears at page 162 in the appendix.
Well, Mr. Hyatt is responsible, and there is some suggestion, and I won't go into details, but there is some suggestion in the requirements that there were some amendments and other things that may have been a bit of a moving target. Aren't you nailing him to the wall with prosecution latches? We handed it to you. Why aren't you using it? Why aren't we seeing those cases? Why are you still kicking around over this procedural stuff? And why don't you just knock these things out so we don't have to deal with all these procedural things?
No one wants to more than we do, Your Honor. We also are aware that we have a need to justify under this court's precedence the actions that we take. That's part of the reason the requirements are so extensive and detailed in this case. And
do you think you couldn't justify the fact that an application was pending from June of 95 and had 115,000 claims and been a moving target? Are you suggesting to me you don't think you could justify a case for prosecution latches?
No, Your Honor, whatever you write in this case, please do not say that we don't think that is true. We will take whatever steps we can. We have assigned 14 full-time examiners to deal with Mr. Hyatt's applications. And I think if you look...
Poor 14 people. How can that 14 people do 115,000 claims?
This is why...
You're going to get a big bonus.
This is...
has to meet whatever quota they've got set for like the next 10 years.
I fully support that, Your Honor.
The office for some reason shies away from the undue multiplicity rejection.
And thank you for raising this point, Your Honor.
Because I can remember 50 years ago when I was an examiner, long time, undue multiplicity was a rather frequently used rejection. If somebody came in with 30, 40, 50 claims and they were very much alike, they would be rejected as unduly multiplied, and at least there would be some interaction.
And I agree with you, Your Honor. Without committing the PTO to anything, part of the point of the requirements is to make that sort of rejection possible. If you look at the page 212 of the Joint Appendix, the agency explains, citing cases like Flint and others, where this court and its predecessor have said that the agency didn't adequately justify an undue multiplicity rejection. Here we are saying, these sure seem unduly multiplicative to us, explain why we're wrong. And we obviously have the power to ask for that, and if the answer is unsatisfactory, and I don't want to prejudge it, then it may well be that the PTO chooses to reject on that ground. But what Mr. Hyatt can't do is say, you know, you can't include the claims from co-pending applications to make out your undue multiplicity objection because that violates Section 122.
Okay, so indulge me. Judge Learned Hand, in 1915, nobody cited this to me, but it's one of my favorite quotes, and I don't get to use it very often, but boy, it actually applies here. The court should discourage practice which permits 48 claims on a simple and perfectly obvious machine like this. Such claims violate the very purpose of any claims at all, which is to define the forbidden field.
Right.
In such a waste of abstract verbiage, it is quite impossible to find any guide. Here's my favorite part. It takes the scholastic ingenuity of a St. Thomas with the patience of a yogi to decipher their meaning.
Your Honor, I would love to have the opportunity to file a brief in which I quoted that case on the merits. That is, regrettably for me, not this case, but I sympathize with the sentiment, and it is the reason why we are taking what we think are very appropriate examination steps to bring this arduous process to a close.
And we've got to bring this argument to a close.
I realize that some of our decisions may have discouraged the Patent Office from making these undue multiplicity rejections, but I think it's something that certainly should be revisited.
and the agency's requirements and the credit's responses thereto to that end should be available to the public.
Yeah. Mr. Panner, you have some rebuttal time. We'll definitely give him this full 5 minutes, and if you really feel the need to go over, I'll certainly let you do that because we did with your opposing counsel.
I'm grateful, Your Honor. Let me start out by suggesting that Mr. Freeman's attempt to portray the prosecution practices here in a way that is unfavorable, and I understand that he has ample fodder in the record for doing that, actually underscores exactly why this court should be careful in this case to ensure that the PTO has justified the disclosure that it threatens here. Mr. Hyatt appears to be in the office a disfavored applicant for whatever set of reasons, his fault, not his fault. He would violently disagree with the idea that the delay in these applications can be laid at his door. An applicant is required by the office to respond to office actions within 3 months. These applications have been suspended 2,000 times for a total of 1,000 years by the office. So the idea that this is to be laid at his door, and that's exactly why the PTO could not do what Your Honor suggested, because the PTO, it's been Mr. Hyatt's consistent effort to get applications adjudicated that is demonstrated by the record that will eventually emerge.
But you have to agree that the fact that he is filing hundreds and hundreds of claims, many of which are seemingly identical, is not aiding the Patent Office in getting these things examined.
I understand that, Your Honor. I don't think that I would gainsay the idea that this is a challenge for the office and that it is certainly to be hoped that a process can get underway that will lead to resolution of this, because that's in Mr. Hyatt's interest, and the government says that it's in its interest as well.
But part of the problem is the fact that the Patent Office, as I see it, is trying in these requirements that they issued, is trying to sort of inform Mr. Hyatt why they're having such a problem and why they need to sort this all out. And you know, maybe from Mr. Hyatt's point of view and this confidentiality issue, it would have been better not to put all these claims in these requirements. But I think the Patent Office was doing that only because they felt if they didn't spell out what the problem is and what the Patent Office is facing, that they wouldn't get any kind of, they wouldn't make any progress with Mr. Hyatt.
And I absolutely appreciate that, Your Honor, and we have not taken issue with the requirements, the form of the requirements, what is being, in this case. We assume that the requirements are going to be there. The issue that we have is simply that by virtue of operation of a regulation that is expressly subject to the statutory duty, there is information, none of this information is about an issued patent, okay? I do want to emphasize that the error, I think, that Mr. Freeman said two things that really made my ears prick up, because one of them was when he was discussing, Your Honor, with Judge Moore about this question of there's a right and then exceptions. And he said, well, the statute says that information may be disclosed. The statute doesn't say is not an authorization to the office to disclose information. It's a grant of a right with limited exception. But that then goes over to the second, what I believe to be misstatement in his argument that I think really should give the court pause. He says the public is entitled to that information, to see how Mr. Hyatt...
Well, to be clear, I understood his argument and as being the public is entitled to the information, meaning if there is a patent out there that Mr. Hyatt may assert against someone, that the public is entitled to the entire chain of the prosecution of that patent, including the parent and anything that happened in that parent. And I think that that is true. It is unequivocal, and I don't think that you would disagree with that.
But not in this. There is no assertion, Your Honor, in this circumstance that the assertion by Mr. Freeman that there was that there is a potential infringement claim out there is a new one. It wasn't asserted in the brief. We didn't have an opportunity to respond to it. But the point is that no one. There is a regulation, after all, which says that in a circumstance where there's a apparent application, someone can pay a fee and get the application filed. That is, in fact, what 1.14 Romanet 5 says. I'm going to forget all the different Romanets, but the point is the regulation that they rely on, which says that the parent should be made available, says it's made available if someone comes and pays a fee. So anybody who says, hey, I'm being sued for infringement, they can pay a fee. But what the government cannot plausibly claim is that there's a patent out there that is not expired as to which this information has any relevance at all. And there's none of the claims that are at issue have issued in a patent. And so that's why what the court ought to be doing, I agree with Your Honor, that the arbitrary and capricious standard in light of the statutory purpose what has been in other statutory contexts adopted as a plain reading of these sorts of exceptions is to require the office to make a showing that the disclosure that is contemplated is tailored to address, I've used the word tailored, which isn't quite the word that I want, but that the disclosure that's contemplated is intended and reasonably will serve an interest under the statute, which I submit that when you peel away the generality about the importance of disclosure of this, you know, with regard to the scope of issued patents is not satisfied here.
Thank you, Mr. Panner. The case is taken under submission.
Thank you for the extra time, Your Honor.